Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 17th, 2017. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, part two of our series with Zach Taggart, lab manager at 42 North Brewing in East Aurora, New York. This week, Zach talks about how to isolate and propagate yeast and bacteria. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. Don't forget to get a copy of our Brewer's Logbook. You can use it to log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can find me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first. Go to our website, basicbrewing.com. Look on the right-hand side of the page. Click on that Amazon logo. It'll take you to Amazon. You can shop to your heart's content. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app at amazon.com. We have a Windows phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We're on Google Play Music. And we're on the iHeartRadio app as well. And if you'll do us the favor of rating us on iTunes, both our audio and video podcasts, and maybe leaving a nice comment there, that will help new listeners find us. And we greatly appreciate you doing that. And finally, if you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. And a great thanks to everybody who's done so already. Yesterday, my wife Susan and I bottled my Cascade Pale Ale test batch that I brewed in my Mr. Beer fermenter to see if it was contaminated. I'm trying to track down why one of my kombucha SCOBY soured beers blew up a couple of weeks ago. I asked Susan what she tasted in a sample of the pale ale, and she said grapefruit. So I'll take that as a good sign. We'll there wasn't any SCOBY floating on the top of the beer after 10 days, you know, so maybe that means the fermenter's okay. So we'll see what happens as the beer conditions. Those bottles are in the bathtub, so they are waiting just in case. My next batch of beer will be a larger batch of a similar recipe. I liked how that turned out. In the smaller batch, the Cascade Pale Ale, instead of adding hops just right at flame out, you know, at the end of the boil, I chilled the wort down a bit before adding that last Cascade addition. My goal was to chill down to 180 degrees Fahrenheit or around 82 C, but I missed it, and I hit the 150 degrees Fahrenheit or around 65 C. But I put the finishing hops in at that temp and let them sit for 15 minutes. So just trying to get the most out of the hop flavor and aroma without, you know, isomerizing any more of those alpha acids to produce more bitterness. I did have more, you know, bittering hops in the beer itself. So it tasted pretty good into the bottle. So I'm going to step up the volume and brew a 5-gallon batch. Crossing fingers for good weather on Monday, when we'll be venturing up into Missouri to watch the solar eclipse. I've been wanting to see a total eclipse for a very long time, so I'm excited at the prospect, and especially excited that my two boys will have a chance to experience it too. And there's more good news on the solar eclipse front. In April 2024, there will be another total eclipse that will pass right over northwest Arkansas, right here. So it's something to look forward to. Make your hotel reservations now. Zach and I talked for a good long time, and I want to get to that. But first, a word from our sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. Pippin's Tap Room is open at High Gravity, and they are serving lower gravity beers right now. But Desiree posted a few days ago that they have gotten zoning approval to brew full-strength beers. So that means the licensing process can proceed to the next step. So that's good news. Desiree and Dave are brewing beers for the tap room on one of their one-barrel, two-vessel electric brewing systems, and it's being controlled by the Warthog EBC-350 controller. And if you go to youtube.com/highgravitybrew, you can see Dave demonstrate that system. It's very cool. Awesome that you can brew a barrel of beer on such a small footprint. But of course, High Gravity sells more than just the big systems. They have electric brewery systems all the way from 5 gallons to 2 barrels, and a variety of Warthog controllers to fit many needs. I love electric brewing. It takes the pain out of propane. So check everything out at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. And if you enter in the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 on your electric brewery system or controller. High Gravity, family-owned and operated, highgravitybrew.com. Now let's get into the second part of our conversation with Zach Taggart, lab manager at 42 North Brewing. Zach Taggart, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me, James.
We got good response from the first time you were on. Last time you were talking about essentially just looking at our yeast and seeing if it's healthy and seeing how much is there as far as cell count wise. We're going to get into a more complicated sort of a situation in the second half. But we did get some questions from listeners from the first half, and I wanted to address those before we go into it. John from Iowa City, Iowa, said, in the first half, you spoke about an experience you had with repitching Y-Yeast 1968 and how eventually you noticed that the beer began to taste off. John asks, knowing that genetic drift of a yeast population when repitching multiple times is a potential concern, is it possible that the repitched yeast just began to produce more off flavors as it adapted to a somewhat more harsh environment? Would the testing as described be able to demonstrate that it wasn't relatively healthy? And is there anything that homebrewers can do to counteract or test for this genetic drift? So do you think that the issues that you were having with that Y-yeast strain, do you think it was genetic drift, or what do you think's going on?
Yes, that's a good question. I brought that example up because it kind of showed that before you engage in these kind of techniques of cell counting and stuff we'll talk about today with plating, you don't really know. And so it could be genetic drift. It could be, contamination. It could be that I was over-pitching or under-pitching chronically over a period of time. Without the microscope, it's tough to say. Now, the things we talked about in the first episode with cell counting, that would help me rule out whether my pitch rates were affecting the flavors. If I was, say, way under pitching, I could be getting some off esters. If I'm pitching not very viable yeast, and then that could allow for some fusels or even some contamination to set in before it gets going. So the cell counting we talked about last time will help you adjust those and address the pitch rate stuff. And today we're going to be talking about using media plates and that kind of thing in your home brewery. And that will help you rule out the contamination side. And we can also talk about what happens if you do have a contamination and trying to get back to your pure culture. But the main point I brought that up was that at that point I had gone through maybe 10 generations of that yeast and I loved it. And then it started to just not produce the kind of beer that it was previously. But at that point, I just kind of had to dump it because I had no way of knowing what it was and no way of clearing up any sort of issue with it.
Right. Adam from Maple Grove, Minnesota, writes, is there a way to harvest yeast from a commercial beer that has not been bottle conditioned?
So that's tough. You can definitely shoot for beers that are bottle conditioned. The tough side with that is that sometimes breweries use a bottle conditioning yeast, and so you don't know if you're getting their primary strain or their bottle conditioning strain. But if you're talking about a beer that is force carbonated, it's going to be tough because some breweries will be using centrifuges or filters to get all the yeast out of there. And so there's likely not much you're going to be able to culture up. If they're just cold crashing their beer to get it somewhat clear, and then they force carb it that way, there might still be some in solution. And if you try doing you know, very delicate steps, you know, low gravity wort, 10, 20, let's say, and very small amounts, maybe start off with, you know, 20 milliliters or something in the bottle, you might be able to coax that back. But trying to pull yeast out of a non-bottle conditioned beer is definitely a challenge.
And Adam also asks, the head brewer at the brewery down the street told me I could have some yeast slurry from the fermenter if I bring a sanitized mason jar. Are there any tips for working with this yeast before I use it to ferment beer at home? Do I need to wash it, or can I use it straight away and a starter?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be nice, healthy yeast. If they're you're doing it on harvesting day, it'll probably be shortly after primary, so it's going to have just dropped out. If you pull the sample, you can take a look at it in the jar and see if there's debris, depending on where they are giving you the sample, whether it's the bottom of the cone or higher up, you'll get more or less trub in there. But take a look at it. You can use it straight off. You can estimate the amount of slurry. Or if you're doing the cell counts like we talked about last time, you can do a little density count and then just pitch it straight into a beer. If there is some debris in there, you could just take a portion of it and put that into a starter and prop it up in a cleaner wort. But that yeast is going to be good to go.
Yeah. That's a luxury, having a having a generous commercial brewer down the street, for sure.
Yeah, no, and it's great. You know, especially small brewers love making building relationships with their community and stuff. And so I think reaching out to your local brewery and showing interest is a good way to go about that. And they're the same, generally the same kind of strains you'll get from the labs, but you are going to get a nice quantity, and it's going to be, in most cases, in pretty good shape. So
this time we are going to talk about, last time we talked, as I said, about counting your yeast population and checking in on its health. This time we're going to get into some more complicated processes. What are we going to talk about this time, Zach?
Okay, so today I wanted to kind of dive into using growth media to isolate and propagate cultures, whether they be brewer's yeast or wild yeast or even bacteria. So the reason that you would do this in your home brewery is you can, one, if you're maintaining a house culture like we talked about, you can do checks to make sure that that's a clean culture. If you're getting some kind of off flavor, like I did with the 1968, you can plate that out and you'll be able to see for sure if there's a contaminant in there. We'll talk a little bit about identifying the contaminants once you, if you do have something pop up on a plate, especially if you're working with like a mixed culture, some, bacteria are going to be helpful to that beer and some that you don't want. So I can give a couple tips on how to start looking at what kind of bacteria you're finding in those. Then, as I mentioned before, if you're getting a contaminant in your culture, you can use plates to build that back up and create a pure culture from scratch, from individual colonies of yeast. And then, you know, finally, I mentioned last time, one of my favorite things is to search out, especially when I go on vacation to new places, I try to find little local breweries that have bottles of cool shift beer or use the beer that uses wild yeast. And then I can use plates to try and pick out and isolate the wild yeast and bacteria in those beers and use them at home. So you can go searching for strains that are only available in these commercial bottles and not from the big labs.
Yeah, that's cool. It definitely adds another dimension to the home brewing process. Now, we got to buy some more stuff. Last time we got a microscope. And the hemocytometer, is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and you mentioned last time that just thinking of it as a counting grid is a good way to go about it. It's really not as intimidating as it sounds.
So what do we got to have this time? What do we got to go out and find?
All right, so you can, if it's something that interests you, you can like kind of test the waters by buying pre-poured plates. You know, if you go on Amazon, you can buy a nutrient agar plate for a pack of 10 for $20 and test it out and see if it's something that you're interested in. If it's something that you want to build into your repertoire, you're going to need a pressure cooker. And those have a huge range of cost, anywhere from your $30 pressure cooker with the little snap-on lid to, you know, a couple $100s that have a nice regulator on it and that kind of thing. What you essentially want to be able to do, though, is to hold 15 PSI for 15 minutes, and that's going to sterilize anything that you put inside. When you're building up cultures from individual colonies, you're taking a very small amount of culture and trying to build it up, and any other contaminants that might be in there are going to be building up alongside it. So the pressure cooker is really important to sterilize your equipment and make sure you're building up just the strains that you want.
Yeah, there's a difference between sanitization and sterilization.
Exactly.
Usually we can get away with sanitizing something, but in something like this, you really need to sterilize and to kill everything.
Right, because you're, you know, an individual, I think they say an individual colony is 1 million cells, and that's just a teeny amount. And so you want to make sure that when you're putting that into some wort, that that's the only thing growing, because it won't necessarily be able to outcompete something else on that small of a dose. So the one thing to look out, though, with pressure cookers, you can go on the cheaper end. You want to do a little reading, though. I've read that some of the cheaper ones, they'll get up to 15 PSI, but they won't necessarily hold it for the duration of those 15 minutes. Mm. It'll kind of fluctuate up and down. And, you know, in the home setting, that might be just fine. So do a little reading on that, but you can get some quality ones that'll last you a lifetime, or you can just grab a used one off Craigslist and give it a shot on your own, but something to look out for. All right, so that's the pressure cooker. You're going to need some Petri dishes, and you can get the little packs of the disposable plastic ones. I got a pack of 20 borosilicate plates, because then I can reuse them. I just afterwards wash them out, get them ready for the next batch, and put new media in it. And that way I'm not throwing out a bunch of plastic every time I want to do some new plates. Mm-hmm. Your media, we'll talk about media in just a minute, but there's a broad range of stuff you can use to grow up yeast and bacteria cultures. But in most cases, you'll have like a powdered media that you'll mix up. That, you know, I get the jugs from Weber Scientific, 500 grams of media powder for $30, and those will last you a long, long time. So it's a little investment in the beginning, but then you're good to go once you get your setup. And then the final thing you'll need is what's called an inoculation loop. And that's essentially just a very thin wire with a loop at the end. And that's what you're going to use to spread your culture on the plate.
So it sounds intimidating, but again, in your presentation for HomebrewCon, you made another video on this process, showing, you know, how you make the plates and all that. And it doesn't look complicated once you see it done.
No, and I'll upload that video for you and send you a link so that your listeners can check that out. It's really quite easy. You do it once or twice, and then you've got it down. I mean, essentially what you're doing is you are mixing the powder into some water in a little beaker, just enough so it dissolves. You put that liquid in the pressure cooker with your plates. You hit that with 15 PSI for 15 minutes, take it out, and then pour into the individual plates out and let them cool. So, you know, looking at these Petri dishes and media and that kind of stuff can sound intimidating, but once you take a look at the video, you'll see it's something you can easily do just in a given evening once you have the process down.
And the AHA has tweeted that the HomebrewCon presentations are out there on the web for those members of the Homebrewers Association who want to go and check those out. So if you didn't get to go to HomebrewCon this year, the presentations are out there. Or if you did get to go and couldn't be five places at once, you know, to attend the sessions, that stuff is out there.
Absolutely.
So what are the different types of media that we're looking at?
Okay, so to start off, you could just do a general growth media. And the one that labs use as the low-level basic one is called YPD. And that sounds complicated, but it's just yeast extract, peptone, and dextrose. And so essentially what it is you're just giving sugar and nutrients to the yeast. So if you wanted to do that at home, you could just get a little dry malt extract and cook it up with a little yeast nutrient, and you basically have your homemade YPD. And you know, I've done that at home, it works great. The with growth media, the issue is that you're going to be able to grow everything. So if there's bacteria in there, it's going to grow. If there's yeast in there, it's going to grow. So it, what you have to do a little more to isolate things, but it's really easy to make if you are if you have a little dry malt extract at home and yeast nutrient. All you have to do is get a little agar to solidify it, and you're good to go. So that will grow everything. There are a bunch of different kinds of media that can help you isolate things, which is kind of cool. The first is a class called differential media. And all it is basically media that has dye in it. And different strains and different organisms will take up the dye at different rates. So let's say you have a culture that has a blend of yeasts and you streak that out on the plate. One of the sets of yeast will appear white, let's say, and the other one will have a slight green tint, so you'll be able to see them apart. And you can do the same thing with the if there's bacteria on the plate. And then the third class, so you have growth media, differential media. The third class is selective media. And what that's going to do is that will have oftentimes a lot of, some form of antibiotic in it. So it'll kill off a specific population so that you can let others grow. So there are some that will kill off the bacteria. There are some that will kill off the yeast. There are some that will kill off just brewer's yeast, Saccharomyces, but it won't kill off things like Brettanomyces. So those are kind of cool. You can go into the lab, scientific lab sites and pick out what kind of media you like if you want to really get into it, depending on if you want to isolate wild stuff or if you're just trying to pull out a yeast strain out of a mixed culture. Lots of options there. But again, if you're getting started, just go for a little wort and agar and you're already in the game.
So what do we do with these plates? I mean, once we got you got the growth media that we like on there, how do you use them?
All right. So, I mean, basically what you have is just a little petri dish and it's got a jelly-like coating on it. You're going to want to put your culture on there. Now when I'm at work and I'm doing contaminant testing, I do something called a pour plate. And what that is I'm taking a very specific amount of either the beer or the slurry and pouring that onto the plate and spreading it out. And the reason I do that is so that I can tell if any bacteria comes up, I can say, oh, I got 3 colonies in 100 microliters. So I can tell exactly how much of the contaminant is in there. If you're doing things like isolating and propagating, what you want to do is called a streak plate. And all that is taking your inoculation loop, putting a little bit of your culture on the plate, and then spreading that across the plate so that you're spreading the sample out so that it can pop up individual colonies along. So there's pattern, you can look them up online, there's different patterns you can do, but essentially you do a little scratch and then kind of spread that out across the rest of the plate so that you can separate the colonies and be able to pick those out.
So how hard is it to get a sample of beer or a sample of slurry that is 100% clean, you know, that doesn't have any bacterial contamination? Is that easy to do or is it hard?
Oh no, not hard at all. I mean, if you're using good sanitation, you'll get most clean samples. I mean, at work, I do contaminant testing, but man, only a very rare case will I actually have stuff pop up in the beer. You know, so in most cases, the pH and the alcohol are gonna kill things off. But in those cases that you do, you want to make sure that the contaminant is in the beer and not just in the air around you. So that's, I don't know if I talked about it the first time, but you can set up next to, let's say, your gas stove, turn on the flame, and that'll get a little bit of heat rising above your plate so that it's keeping out anything from falling on top of your plate. You want a kind of a clean environment to do your streaking on so that you know that the contaminant is not coming from the air, it's coming from your sample. So, you know, I do it next to my gas stove at home, but if you have a little gas burner or even a propane torch, you can just turn that on next to your little setup, and that'll create kind of like a drift around your work area so that stuff isn't floating into your space.
What about a ventilation hood over you know, like at home? People have ventilation hoods over their stoves. Will that be sufficient?
Yeah, you know, I would do the ventilation hood and then the heat on the gas stove and you'll be set. I mean, in labs, they have these big sealed off cabinets that are basically a fancy ventilation hood. So yeah, that would definitely help out. You know, the bare minimum is that you don't want drafts in your room. So close the windows, close the doors. You know, I try to make sure that my kids aren't going to be walking through, or the dog's not going to come up and check out what I'm doing. You know, we're at home. If we make a mistake, it's not a big deal. So I think you just do your best is to keep a clean environment. And I have, if you go back and look at my presentation, I have a list of things you might want to consider to get there. And there's also in the yeast book, Chris White's book, he has a good list there of how to set up your home lab. But, you know, very minimal things you can do to just ensure that the results you're getting are from your sample.
Now, we've got our plates, and we've either flooded them or we've streaked them. So how long is it going to take to see results, and what conditions do we have to keep those in?
Okay, so you want to try and keep it in kind of a warm area. In general, the yeast are going to propagate best at around 85 degrees. So you want to, it will propagate at lower temperatures. And, you know, at work, I have an incubator. At home, I don't have one. So in the wintertime, I have a little closet in our living room that has a heat vent going through it. So it's pretty warm in there. And so I put my plates on a little shelf in there, and that keeps the temperature up. Basically, the warmer temperature will encourage the yeast to pop up quicker. In general, the brewer's yeast is going to show up in, you know, like 1 to 3 days. Wild yeast, like Brettanomyces, tend to take a little bit longer, and bacteria as well. But what it comes down to is the cooler it is, the longer it's going to take. So it will show up if you do it at room temperature. It's just going to take a few more days. The other things that you want to look out for are humidity. If you're in a very humid environment, you could be encouraging the growth of mold on your plate, which will then contaminate your sample. So that's something to think about. If you're in a really dry environment, your plates will dry out faster. So they'll start to shrivel and crack and that kind of thing. So you generally want just kind of like mid-range humidity. I know we don't tend to have a lot of control over that. So just something to look out for.
And I'm assuming that these plates are covered, right? They're not just yes. Open to the air.
Yep. So they have a lid that just kind of sits on top. And you don't need to tape them down or anything, just a loose lid fitting on top, and a closed environment that's warm will do the trick.
And for our metric people, 85 degrees Fahrenheit is around
30
Celsius.
Yep.
So, okay. There you go.
And, you know, I was looking on, before we started talking, I just took a quick look on Craigslist. If you look up egg incubators, you can usually, especially if you're living near a rural environment, you can find egg incubators for, you know, under $50, and those will do the trick as far as keeping a nice warm environment for you.
Cool. We bought a microscope the first time for cell counting and looking at the health of our cells. But the microscope that you're going to recommend as the minimum is a bit better than the one that you recommended for the first one, right?
Yes. So when we were doing the cell counting, we were using a 400x magnification. If you want to start getting into looking at Brettanomyces or Lactobacillus, Pediococcus, you're going to need a 1000x scope. And something to look out for, one of your listeners wrote in and asked a couple questions about a scope. There are some, and I might have mentioned this the first time, that have a 20x ocular, and they use that to reach 1000x. You want to try to avoid those, because what that's doing is that's taking a lower objective. The objective is the lens that's closest to your sample, and then the ocular is the one you look in. And together, they need to make 1000. So what you really want is one that's 100 on the objective and 10 on the ocular. If you have a 20 ocular, it means your objective is not as good. And so it's just making the image bigger, but not clearer. So when you look for those scopes, you want 100x objective and a 10x ocular to make your 1000. And they're oftentimes labeled as, they're called oil immersion, because when you're doing it at this level of magnification, what you do is you basically just drop a little bit of oil so that the image contacts the lens and it makes it clear. Sounds complicated, but it'll be in the directions for your scope. It's really easy.
And Tony was the listener that he actually sent you a link to a microscope on Amazon and said, "How about this one?" So you were kind enough to take the time and kind of walk him through the process of finding, you know, a good scope. So I know Tony appreciates that.
Oh yeah, and he was, you know, getting in the. I love to hear people getting ready to start their breweries and looking at lab stuff right off the bat. So he said he was going to start up like a 2-barrel brewery or something and already looking at scope. So I think that's it's a good start for him.
Yeah. Now what do we do with this stuff? I mean, we've got these plates and we've got these colonies on the plates, right?
Yes.
How do we know what we're looking at and what do we do with this stuff?
All right. So you're going to take a look at your plate and you're going to see lots of little round colonies forming on it. In general, your yeast are going to be white and opaque and round. So they're going to be the creamy white color, kind of like the color that you see when you have a slurry. And so those will be easy to pick out. Bacteria come in a range of different colors and textures and that kind of thing. The one thing that does tend to give them away is they often have a slimy appearance. So you can have white bacteria on your plate, but it'll look kind of like mucus. It'll have like a shiny coating to it. Mm. And that's a giveaway that that's probably a bacteria, whereas the yeast are going to be more creamy. And then mold is pretty, when there are larger colonies, they're pretty easy to identify by the eye because you'll see that hairy texture to it. Once you get those under the scope, you'll be able to see those. You know, small colonies can be hard to identify, but when you get them under the scope, you can see those big, long hyphae, which are the hairs, and that's the giveaway for that. But those are the three main things you'll look for. So if you're just dealing with the yeast, you want to see nice, creamy, white colonies on there. And if you do get some bacteria, what you can do is you can put those under the scope and take a look. And under the microscope, you'll have yeast, which will be, like we talked about last time, nice big round cells. Wild yeast are usually about half the size of those or even smaller, but they'll still be round cells. Sometimes they're ellipsoid, but generally look similar to the brewer's yeast cells that we use all the time. And the bacteria then are going to be into a couple classes. You'll have rods, which is your things like lactobacillus, and it just looks like a little pill-shaped object under the scope. And then you'll have cocci, which would be things like pediococcus, and those will be a round cell, similar to the yeast, but it's going to be so, so small. That's why you need that 1,000 X magnification. And then the molds, as I said earlier, will have some round cells, but they'll have these big kind of fibrous cells coming out, and so they're easy to spot.
So we know we don't want mold in our beer, right?
Right.
but we, you know, we have talked about lactobacillus and pediococcus and things like that. How can you tell, you know, when you're culturing up bacteria, which we generally all our life have, you know, been told to keep out of our food and food products? How can you tell the stuff that's good for brewing, and how can you tell the stuff that's not going to hurt us?
So to do that, all you need is something called a Gram stain kit, and that you can get, you know, you can pull those off Amazon for $30. It'll come with four little solutions that you can use to help identify. So most bacteria is classified as either Gram positive or Gram negative. And essentially what that means is the Gram positive cells and Gram negative cells have something on the outside, a compound on the outside of their cell membrane. The gram-positive ones have a more of it. And so when you put dye into it, it can retain that dye. Whereas the gram-negative ones, you put dye in it and you wash it with a little alcohol, and that dye is going to wash out. So then you can look under the microscope and differentiate those. The gram-positive ones will appear purple. The gram-negative ones will appear pink. And so I can walk you through that process if that's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, which one do we want? Which one do we want to avoid?
good question. So, in general, the ones that you're going to be using in brewing wild beers are Gram positive. That's going to be your lactobacillus, pediococcus, that kind of thing. The Gram negative ones, if you get one, is going to be a sign that there's something in there that you don't want. That could be things like acetic acid, bacteria, enterobacter, that kind of thing. So if you're doing your gram stains, you want to see purple for sure. And so when you get that kit, you're going to get those four solutions. You get a crystal violet, a Graham's iodine, you get your little alcohol wash, and then a safranin. And crystal violet's your purple stain, safranin's your pink stain. And basically what you do is you stain it all purple at first. You put a little of your second solution, Graham's iodine, in there to fix that on there. You rinse it with alcohol. Your Graham-positive ones are going to stay purple, but that purple is going to be washed out of the Graham-negative ones. And then finally, you put the safranin on there to stain it pink so that your Graham-negative ones are easier to see. They'll pop up as pink rather than being clear. Hmm. And so once you have that, you know, you can combine that with your other observations. And if this is something that interests you, go check out the presentation, because I have a lot more details on how to work on identifying what you found. But if you look at the shape, you know, is it a rod or is it a cocci? Is it in chains or look, how is it grouped up under the microscope? Is it gram positive, negative? In the presentation, I also go over the catalase test, which is basically just putting a drop of hydrogen peroxide in it and seeing what happens. So there's a bunch of different little things you can do to kind of categorize it. You won't know for sure what you have unless you send it to a lab and get it sequenced, but you can narrow it down. I know we had an issue with one of our barrels at work. It was developing a little bit of nail polish remover kind of smell to it, which is a sign of ethyl acetate. And so we wanted to know, is this just, it was a sour beer. So is this just the Pediococcus and the Brett interacting to make this, or is this some other contaminant? And so I looked at it under the scope, and sure enough, it was a short gram-negative rod. And so, that can't be Pediococcus, because Pediococcus is going to be round. And so it told us that we had something else. And turned out it was Acetobacter. But just taking these little signals of what you see on the plate, what you see under the scope, can help you narrow down what this might be.
Now we've gotten either our commercial sample from a bottle, or we've set out wort out in the environment to collect these interesting critters, as some people call them, and so we've isolated some strains that we're curious about, and we want to grow up and use in our beers. Where do we take this from here? How do we make these little bitty samples into something that we can brew with?
Okay, so let's say you have your house culture, and you've gotten some kind of contamination, or you've like you said, pulled a wild capture, and you want to be able to isolate just that yeast. You're going to want to pick that colony off the plate and put it into some wort. But you, again, like we said earlier, it needs to be a sterile environment for it. So here again, you're going to use your pressure cooker. And all you need to do, you're stepping up, is autoclavable test tubes. And these are real cheap. Just a test tube with a cap on it. And you want to make sure that when you go on Amazon and you look for test tubes, that it's autoclavable. Otherwise, you'll have the problem I did with having a kitchen that stinks of melted plastic and your wife complaining about what's going on in there. So... What the autoclavable, they're a different kind of plastic. It's more durable, and then it has a silicone ring on the inside so that you can seal it off. And that's, heat resistant at the temperatures you'll be working. So essentially what you're doing is you're taking your test tubes, you fill them up with a little low-gravity wort, you pressure cook them, and now you have these sealed little capsules that you can put colonies into. And I just have a little beaker in my fridge with these tubes ready to go. Do like 10, 15 of them at a time and just keep them in there, and you'll have a little sterile test tube of wort so that when you want to pick a colony off a plate, you pop it in there, screw the cap back on, give it a little shake every now and then, and pretty soon you'll start to see a little foaming on there. Hmm. Because you really want the colony is such a small amount of yeast, you want to start real slow and building it up. And so the lowest end you're going to want to work with is, like 15 to 30 milliliters at a time. And then you can step up from there once you see activity.
For the same reason, you don't want to underpitch your beer. You don't want to underpitch your teeny tiny starters.
Right, or overwhelm it with too much. So just starting off slow with low gravity and no hop work, you know, that'll start building it up. If you're finding you're looking at your plate and there's a decent amount of contaminant on there or bacteria on there, you can take one or two colonies off of there and restreak it onto another plate to try and purify it a little bit more. Hmm. If you're worried that your inoculation loop might be touching the colony next to it that's bacteria, yeah, pull a little bit of that off, restreak it, and on your next plate, you're going to have a lot more yeast and a lot less bacteria. So you can do some restreaking to try and purify it, or like we talked about earlier, the selective or differential media helps out there as well.
And can we tell, you know, if it's by looking at the colonies on the plate, you know, like if you're collecting a sample from the wild, can you look at yeast colonies on the plate and are there indications that those would be good for brewing or do you have to like do a test batch to actually test the properties?
I mean, I would definitely, as you're growing up, do a test batch just to make sure you got the colony that you thought you were wanted to get. But there are some guidelines on when you're picking these colonies, because you're going to see, when you do a streak plate, you're going to see tons of little circles all over your plate. And when you want to select those, there's a question in your mind, you know, which ones do I pick? So in general, you want to pick ones that are medium-sized. The real teeny ones could be what's called a respiratory mutant. Real big ones could be a colony that's enveloped another colony and they're fighting for resources. So you really just want one that's isolated and is a medium size. It's also good to make sure they have a nice crisp edge, especially if you're dealing with a lab strain. They're going to be nice, crisp brown circles. Wild yeast tend to have a more crenulated border, but for the lab yeast, they're going to be nice and crisp. Any cells that look, or colonies that look irregular, you don't want to choose. If they're darker, let's say, if they have an off color, and avoid areas that have contaminants close by. Bacteria is really small, and those colonies, when they first start, are basically invisible to the eye. So, you know, do yourself a favor and just pick colonies that are away from where your contaminants might be. And then again, you can restreak if you need to.
And we can go two directions. We can propagate this up into a pitchable amount of yeast, or we can, you know, essentially bank this and put it in the fridge, right? Or save it for future when you want to propagate it up, right?
Right. So yeah. So we can get into the yeast banking. I would propagate it up a little bit more before you start thinking about banking it. I would tend to bank slurry that's been on a yeast starter and has a nice big healthy density to it. But you know, like we said with the 1968 example earlier, if I had banked that culture in my freezer previously, then once it starts to go off, I could just go back to that bank and prop it up again. Mm. And yeast banking is like super easy. If you don't get into any of the plating stuff, have your hand at yeast banking, because really easy, doesn't take a lot of expertise, and then you can have these stored cultures in your freezer that you know are pure that you can prop up anytime a culture goes bad. So to do this, you know, all you need is you need your pressure cooker again. You'll need glycerin. There's two ways to do it. There's slants, and then there's the glycerin tubes. A slant is basically a petri dish in a test tube. So you're going to have like an agar kind of solution in your test tube, and you'll have it tipped to the side to make it so that it has a big surface area, and you'll streak out your colonies on top. The glycerin, I find, is much easier, and I think if you're going in as an entry level, it's the way to go. Essentially, what you're doing is you're adding glycerin to your slurry of yeast and water so that it reduces the amount of crystals that form as it starts to freeze, and they don't burst the yeast cells. Mm. And so all you need is your pressure cooker, your test tubes, and your glycerin. And you want to do a solution of about 15% glycerin. You can go up to You know, you could go as high as 50, but then you start affecting the viability of the yeast. So a general rule of thumb is 15%. When you get your glycerin, you can get it from even like a health food store or Amazon. It'll say food grade 100% glycerin or 99.9% pure. It's going to be like syrup. So the first step is to dilute that out a little. So I make a little 50-50 solution of glycerin and water. And then I fill up my tubes. You know, in that case, since you're doubling the volume there with water, that's going to want to be 30% full. So you get your 15% glycerin in there. Pop those in your pressure cooker for 15 minutes. And now those tubes are ready to get slurry anytime. So next time you have a starter that you're overbuilding and you have a little excess you want to save, fill the rest of that tube up with slurry and put that in the freezer. And that's going to be good to go next time you need to go back to a pure culture.
Wow. And then how do you revive that? How do you, once you've got your sample frozen and say you want to brew a specific type of beer that calls for that specific yeast, how do you, what are the steps that you got to do to use it?
So you want to, when you're doing the freezing and unfreezing, you want to do it slowly. The more you can slow down the process, the easier it's going to be on that culture, because being frozen is a pretty harsh environment for it. A tip going in is that you take, once you fill up your test tube with the slurry, put that in the fridge for a couple of days to cool that down to fridge temp, and then put it in your freezer so that it has a nice transition in. And then you can do the same thing coming out. Take your tube out of your freezer. Don't use it right away. You know, pop it in the fridge for a day or two to let that sort of slowly raise up in temperature. And when I'm talking about a freezer, you want to be using like a chest freezer. The freezers that are attached to fridges tend to be so that they don't build up with ice. They tend to cycle between being frozen and being just under frozen so that the ice melts off. Mm. But those swings in temperature are not going to be as good for your yeast. You can do it and you can insulate your container real well, but they'll be much better off in a chest freezer that's going to maintain a steady temperature.
I guess you could try to surround your samples with ice or something to kind of stabilize the temperature if you don't have access to a chest freezer.
Exactly. Yep. You can put ice packs in there. I've heard of people putting it in like a alcohol, so like vodka solution, just to maintain that temperature. But the swings are what's going to reduce your viability. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing to watch out for, and it's kind of funny, the first time I did it, I made a bunch of tubes all at once, put them in the freezer. You know, a couple weeks later, really excited to like check them out, and pulled one out and it was frozen solid. I thought, oh my gosh, I just ruined all this, all these samples of yeast. But they will freeze at 15% glycerin. They will freeze solid. It's not going to stop the freezing. As I said, it's just going to slow down the process of freezing so that the crystals that form are much smaller and don't rupture your yeast. Hmm. So if you see a frozen tube, don't worry. Thaw it out slowly and it'll be fine. And then, you know, the last tip for having a yeast bank is just keeping a good inventory. Keep a little, you know, in your brewing log, keep a little list of what's in there, what the source was, what generation it is. And, you know, that way you're not going in and out of your chest freezer, opening up, exposing it to warm temperatures and then sealing it back up. You'll know what's in there whenever you need it. You can just go and pull that out without disturbing the rest of your stock. But, you know, again, take a look online. There are great videos on there about freezing yeast. And it's, once you see it, the process, you'll say to yourself, oh, I can do that. That's not a problem. And it's, you know, one of the easier lab-based things you can do in your home.
And then from there, it's just a matter of making a series of progressively larger starters.
That's right. Just like when you're building off the plates, you know, you'll start off small. You know, if your tubes are, you know, let's say 20 milliliters of slurry, you know, start it off in 100 milliliters of wort of 1020. And then after that, after it's kind of starting to show activity and reviving, then you can bump it up. You can do 1040. You can do steps of like 5 times the volume, 10 times the volume. And, you know, once it's after the first step, I find they're pretty reinvigorated and ready to go. So just go easy on that first step. And then after that, you can build up as you would normally.
So it takes a little preparation and a little planning ahead. a little time, but, you know, the spur of the moment brewers may need to reconfigure their activities, but it should be well worth it, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, I tend to take one evening. Oh, this will be my pressure cooking evening, and I make a bunch of little wort tubes, and I make a bunch of little glycerin tubes, and then they're in the fridge for when I need them, so that when I have a good starter going, I can pour a little yeast in there for freezing, or when I have a plate that's ready, I can just pop that out of the fridge. And if those tubes are sealed and ready to go, they'll last for quite a while without any worries.
Well, cool. Any last tips that we didn't talk about, or anything that we've left on the table that we need to talk about?
No, I mean, once you've tried these things out, they become really easy, and then it's all about just having fun and hunting down the cool cultures that you want to find. I am currently working on a culture that I got off of organic strawberries from our local farm. And, you know, it's pretty cool to think that I'll be able to brew with that something that will have a profile that will be pretty unique in itself. And, you know, keep in mind that when you're dealing with wild cultures, you're going to get lots of fails before you find one that's good. Hmm. Most yeast that are out there floating around or on leaves or on fruit are going to not necessarily produce the profile that you want, are not going to attenuate the sugars that you want. So it's going to take some trying, but, you know, if you work at it, you can get your own unique culture out of nature and have a beer that's unique just to you, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, and also hunt down those beers that you love and that you can't get yeast from in the banks, and pull that yeast out and use it in your home brewery and to make something really that satisfies your palate.
Yeah, Kevin Welch from Boom Island Brewing Company was talking about traveling through Belgium with his little, you know, with his pockets full of little vials to take samples.
Yeah,
back
there was
home.
There was a picture of at the HomebrewCon of Jeff Mello from Bootleg Biology, or actually one of his buddies, you know, outside of the convention, pulling flowers off the bushes. So yeah, it can really become a fun part of the hobby. I tend to, you know, some people really get into the recipe building and you know, into the different varieties of hops and that kind of thing. But you can also spin off and get really into the yeast. I think it's a lot of fun, and it gives a lot of character to your beer.
Well, very, very cool. Very inspirational. I appreciate it again. This has been fun again, and we'll put the – I put the video on basicbrewingradio.com in the description of this episode last time when we talked. And it's going to be on YouTube as well, Your brewery 42 North has a channel on YouTube that people should search for and find the videos there as well. Also, if you're a member of the American Homebrewers Association, go to the HomebrewCon website and search out Zach's presentation along with all the rest of them there. So lots of good information.
And I'll send you the link for not only the making media plates, but I also have one for gram staining, if that's something that interests people, you know, the quick process video. And there's tons out there, so don't feel constrained to mine. But, yeah, check it out if you guys have questions, and just let me know.
Awesome. Thanks, Zach.
Yeah, thank you, James. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks again to Zach. He makes it all sound and look easy. And as I said, you can go to the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com to check out Zach's videos. Or search for 42 North on YouTube to find their channel, and it's worth a look, especially if you want to get into this kind of thing. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcast. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can find our logbooks where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Mad Monkey Coffee Capsules, Swingin' Bold 48 Count, and Eclipse Glasses, CE Certified Safe Solar Eclipse Glasses. Got me some of them too. So excited. Thanks again, and remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.